that rolling. Somewhere in here you have attendings. Quiz, homework, quiz. 118. So I did finish your exams, but I realized when I ran into one of my students in another class, I forgot to turn them on. So at some point tonight, I'll turn them on so you can see your exams. Let's see. Keep in mind at this point, the exam average is just the average of taking exam number one, adding it to exam number two, and then dividing by two. That really doesn't mean much, but it does not include 70% of your final average. 20% is your paper. Sam was here, wasn't he?
Yes.
Oh, he snuck out? Okay. So, if you did not do well on either of the first two exams, there is the paper that you can worry about. Plus, we're also heading towards exam number three, which will definitely be before Thanksgiving. So we have to take that into consideration. That's another 15%. And on top of that, we have your final. So, lots of points left on the table. Unfortunately, only a couple of you have perfect attendance. So if you end up the semester with perfect attendance, you will get extra points. And also within the realm of unfortunately, some of you have gone over the six allowed absences, which means your average will be penalized, as it's stated on the syllabus. So there's lots of things that are still in movement. So my advice is, if your grades aren't great or if you've missed too many classes, do some of the extra credit. Do this chapter section reviews. For this exam, I think there's two chapters that you could do. So that's some points that you could use to offset any type of penalties. That's not a bad thing. Plus, when we get to the final exam, there is a packet in Engage that's called like the wicked big packet for the final. Don't do that. That's for the final. But that will be there. And also don't forget, your final will not be an online exam. It will be in person. And it will be worth 35%. So, for those of you that test well, you should be able to be fine when the end of the semester comes. Papers. A couple of people in my other class that's doing a paper have already submitted it. Only one got extra credit, but a couple of them gotten in. Time is short. November 22nd is the due date. Tick, tick, tick. Time is passing. All right. So, we're in China. We got the Qing Dynasty. The Qing is starting to crumble. You got all the outward signs of the dynastic circle is a spinning. You have man-made disasters that we're talking about. There was also a couple of natural disasters that I mentioned previously, like when the banks of the Yangtze overflowed and wiped out millions of people's homes, and famine broke out, and disease, and bad things are starting to occur, and people are starting to realize the mandate is potentially lost. And the dynasty is full of weak, incompetent rulers that do not have the ability to do anything about it. Case in point, there was an attempt to fix the problems right after one of the worst man-made disasters in all of Chinese history. The Tiananmen Revolt, Taiping Revolt rather, revolution. Millions of people dead. Billions of property destroyed. And you had some of these warlords, these Confucian scholars that said, look, we can fix the problems. We can save China. And what ended up happening? Nah, we don't need to do it. So problems started getting worse and worse. Fast forward to the 1890s. During the reign of the Emperor Guangzhou, he is shocked into the realization that something needs to be done. And he begins reaching out to his advisors and trying to find possible solutions to the problems that China is facing. And it could not be denied that China, the longest existing civilization on Earth, has been exposed to be nothing but a paper tiger. Look at what the British did with a few thousand soldiers, what the French did, what the Germans, the Americans, the Russians. They didn't invade with millions and millions of men, only a few thousand. Completely decimated the Chinese military forces and forced the emperors at proverbial gunpoint to sign these uneven treaties. And there was nothing the Chinese could do about it. The Opium Wars. There was a war that China fought against France, known as the Sino-French War. The multiple unequal treaties. And the fact that newcomers, like the Germans, are coming in and just doing whatever they want. It's painfully apparent that something is off. But as bad as all of that was, something was even more devastating towards Chinese pride. In 1894, Japan fought a war with China and kicked the living snot out of them. This was a huge blow because traditionally China, being a nation of xenophobes, racists, believed that they were the superior Asian race and that all of the other Asians, the Koreans, the Vietnamese, the Cambodians, all of the other Asians were inferior. And now the Japanese, who modernized, did all the reforms that were talked about three decades before, and used those advances to completely decimate Chinese forces and take Korea as a sphere of influence? The emperor said no more. He ordered his advisors to begin the process of mapping out a reform effort aimed at bringing China into the 19th century. That was on the cusp of entering the 20th century. The emperor wanted a monarchy like the Europeans had, a constitutional monarchy. The emperor wanted capitalism. They wanted to open up modern trade schools, like vocational schools, agricultural schools. They wanted to open modern military academies and naval academies. Bless you. They wanted to have the government oversee the construction of railroads and mining operations. No more giving them to these foreign countries. But most significant, they wanted to get rid of the Confucian exams. Because it was clear, at least to the emperor, that these scholar gentry passing a two, three-day exam based on books that were 3,000 years old no longer was allowing China to be competitive. So he wanted to get rid of that and replace it with a modern bureaucracy, where people get hired based on merit. merit based on modern standards.
But here is the thing. The emperor was the emperor, but he was not an absolute ruler. He was a figurehead. So, the conservative elements within the ruling class turned against him.
They didn't want any change because they could lose their jobs. They could lose their influence. They could lose their lands, their monies. Oh my God, they actually might have to go get jobs. No one wanted to do that. So, this ruling class began holding secret meetings with the Emperor Dowager, Shershi. Who was Shershi? She was a concubine. What's a concubine? She was one of the ladies that the emperor had in the Forbidden Palace that he could sleep with, in addition to the empress. Shershi was the emperor's favorite concubine. The emperor Xiang Fang, who we talked about, that got his butt whipped in the Second Opium War. Unfortunately, the empress did not give birth to a son, but she did. So, when that occurred, the emperor got rid of his wife and named Shershi to be the new wife. So she becomes empress. And because she's the mother of Jiang Fang's son, who would become emperor, that is the emperor Tongzhu, she gets the status empress dowager, which is like the queen mother. And she holds that position as long as she's alive. Well, unfortunately, Tongzhu died in 1871. So when her son dies, she picks her nephew, Guangzhu, to become emperor. Because at least it's in the family, her family. She's powerful, she is influential, and she is feared. Think about it. She went from basically being a kept hooker to the most powerful woman in China. She wasn't an idiot. But now, when all of the conservatives are outraged by what her nephew is doing, she, being the kingmaker, decides to take action. She launches a coup against her nephew. She can't kill him, but he gets captured and placed under house arrest. She publicly declares it's because he was heartbroken over the state of the nation. And she then declared herself to be regent, which means she is in charge. When this occurred, all of the talk of her nephew about changing everything was squashed. Because she was opposed to it. So what happens? Well, anyone who advocates for reform is either captured and executed or driven out of China. Any money that's been allocated in the budget to fund reforms get seized and repurposed. My favorite use of the money was she took all of the money that was put in the budget to build an entire modern navy of about 50 ships and ordered the construction of a huge marble yacht. A marble yacht. Y'all know what marble is, right?
Yeah, it's stone. It ain't gonna float.
Doesn't matter. She orders an artificial lake to be made where this marble yacht is to be constructed in, and she had servants around the artificial lake churning the water to make it sound like she was in a real body of water while she sat on this marble pleasure yacht.
That's crazy.
The money, and by the way, at this point, they didn't have the dreadnoughts yet, but they were definitely ironclad, steam-powered ships. 50 of them. Make one thing for her.
I thought you said she was smart.
She was. She made all the money that was supposed to end her lifestyle disappear. I didn't say that, but for her, it was brilliant. Because if you want to stop reform, you make it so there's no money for reform. It all gets spent. What did Homeland Security tell all the people that are down in Georgia and Tennessee and North Carolina and Florida, vis-a-vis FEMA money that had been spent on sending all the illegal immigrants across our country? Well, it's all gone. And not only does she stymie the efforts to reform China, she also begins pushing for support of groups that were opposed to the Europeans being in China. She began funneling money like Iran does to all of those terrorist groups that are in the Middle East. And it was quid pro quo. You don't criticize the government. You only go against the barbarians, and we'll give you money. We'll give you weapons. We'll give you support. So that way she could turn around and say, hey, it has nothing to do with me. Out of all of the groups that she supported, one of the largest groups were a group that would become known as the Boxers. And these Boxers would launch a rebellion against the intrusion of the barbarians in 1900. It's going to flip screens. So I'll give you all a minute to write it down. The Boxers technically were known as the Yuentong, which is Chinese for the Militia United in Righteousness. The Militia United in Righteousness. But they became known as the Boxers by the Europeans. Because guess what they did? They did the Kung Fu. They believed that by engaging in certain forms of martial arts, they could receive the impervious spiritual armor of their ancestors, which would allow them to repel the barbarians from China and thus cleanse the nation of all of the impurities that has been allowed to seep in.
Dan Bailey.
Yeah, exactly. And they had a slogan: support the Qing and exterminate the foreigners.
Well, here's the thing. The people that had penetrated China the most were Christian missionaries and businessmen. Well, if the Boxers found out there was a Christian missionary in a town, they'd go and find him. They'd kill him. Or if there was a businessman in town, they'd find him. They'd kill him. Eventually, word started spreading to the Europeans. Something's going on in China. But the most bold move made by the Boxers was when the Imperial Army allowed them to enter the capital, and they descended upon what was known as the Legation Quarter. All of these pink buildings are the different embassies that were allowed to be built in the capital after the end of the Second Opium War. So guess who's in these buildings?
Foreigners.
Foreigners. Diplomats. Secretaries. Guess who's not there? Marines. Now the irony is who was there? The British, the French, the Austrians, the Germans, the Russians, the Japanese, the Americans, the Italians. All of the nations that just 15 years later would fight against one another in one of the most catastrophic events in human history, the First World War. But in 1919, they were all being attacked by the Boxers. Well, the legation was put under siege for 55 days. And then on top of that, Zhu Xi ordered the Chinese army to go to war with the foreigners. So the Imperial Army mobilizes and supports the Boxers. But in this, we can call this a wedge issue. It's one thing for Zhu Xi to spend money and support these groups, but it's another to deploy the military. Because if the military is formally deployed, what does this say? Exactly. That it's not just a bunch of criminals that are doing this, that it's the regime. And when one regime attacks other regimes, we call that war. But here's the funny thing. Some of her own family, including Prince Qing, who was technically the commander-in-chief of the Imperial Army, refused to go along with her. And instead demanded that they reach out to the foreigners quickly and say, we have nothing to do with this. But guess what happened to the prince? He didn't get killed, but he got arrested and he got put under house arrest. And man, did the Europeans respond quickly. All of the nations that I mentioned, not that you need to remember them all, but England, Russia, Japan, the United States, Germany, Italy, France, Austria, Hungary. They all formed an eight-nation alliance, and I love this picture. Because in it, you see, you have, oh, there's some troops that come from India. There's a British official. There's a French official. Oh, there's another guy with a big turban on his head. There's a German sailor. There's an American officer. Where's the Japanese? Oh, the Japanese are over there. I mean...
So you're saying they all teamed up just...
They all basically said, okay, you're going to attack us? Well, now the whole world's going to go against China. ...20,000 troops were quickly mobilized by seven of the nations, and Russia would move in four armies, 200,000 men.
drove into Mongolia.
Wait, how many men?
Seven of the nations had 20,000 men that they were able to mobilize quick. Russia added another 200,000.
And this is kind of obvious. The Chinese did not do well, nor did the Boxers. Because you can be strong with your kung fu, but at this point, they have breech-loading bolt-action rifles. You do kung fu, I'm going to bring a Lee Enfield.
Because they had already blown up the Taku forts long before there were no defenses, so the European military forces sailed right to the capital. Forced their way into the city, ended the siege of the foreign legate quarter, and then unleashed hell.
Is a boxer. He's got his braid. He's using that as like a leash. And we have a Chinese official with a big machete. His head is going to end up like that guy's head. Disconnected. Once the Boxers were crushed, there would be a coup against Zhurxi, and all of the government officials that were against her would reestablish the emperor's authority, and they worked in accordance with the will of the allies. And it resulted in basically a purge. Any government official that was associated with the Boxer Rebellion would not go to trial, would not have their day in court. There would be no jury. No, you suffered a summary execution. Meaning they found you, dragged you out in the street, and cut your head off.
The Allies then forced upon the Chinese what is known as the Boxer Protocol.
Now, the interesting thing about this was, unlike all of the unequal treaties, all of the European nations decided we're not going to take any more land. But they wanted any government official that helped the Boxers executed. The only exception was Zhurxi. Which the Chinese agreed to. Second part of the Boxer Protocols, going forward, the nations would be allowed to station soldiers in the litigation quarter. So now in all of those embassies, it's not just going to be ambassadors and secretaries, there will be soldiers there as well, fully armed. Including with machine guns.
So, kill all those who supported the Boxers. Troops in the capital.
And last but not least, money. 720 million ounces of silver. 720 million ounces of silver. So multiply that by the $44 an ounce that silver is currently, and that's a lot of money. 720 million. FYI, that was more than the entire tax
revenue of China.
How much is it?
It doesn't even fit. Hold on. $31,680,000,000.
All right, that's pretty cool.
That's money?
Yeah. That's money.
Now, if you had that much, what would you do with it?
Never
come back. Me? Personally?
This person alive.
That's called disappearing money.
Facts?
Yeah, I'll donate facts. Something and disappear.
What do you mean?
Yeah.
If I had 30-something trillion dollars, yeah, I'd be gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even know if I'd do that. I'd just disappear.
No, I'll donate some to a cancer fund because my mom.
Oh, that's a good cause.
And then I'll keep the rest.
Actually, you could give enough money, you could have a hospital named after your mom.
And a pin in my name.
Yeah, all right. That's better.
All right, so, lots of money. Lots of money. But here's the thing. Now, China has no control over its people. China has no control over foreigners. Who's in charge? What's going on? Do they even have a government? Well, truth be told, they are now in the 11th hour on our dynastic circle, our imaginary clock. All that it's going to take is for some group internally to rise up and rebel and topple the dynasty. And ironically, that began to occur the moment the Boxer Rebellion was suppressed. Soon, all over China, secret societies began to come out of the shadows and openly resist the dynasty. Groups with names like the Triads, or the Society of Elders, or the Society of Brothers, and other groups began popping up. These underground organizations recruited men, gathered resources, but they were not coordinating with one another. So they would engage in local strikes, like cells. They would engage in assassination attempts. They would engage in destruction of property. They would target government officials. But again, they were all doing their own local thing. And the funny thing is, they were just like any other revolutionaries or terrorists. This is one of the most amazing things that I would never have thought of when I was your age. Terrorists don't come from poor families. They can't afford to.
It's expensive.
It is. Most of the terrorists come from middle or upper class families. Including Lenin and Stalin. Mao Zedong.
Pol Pot,
yeah. Why? Well, very simple. The sons of these wealthy people in China, the scholar gentry, the merchants, the people who had money, what the parents were doing is they were sending their kids abroad to go to college in places like France. And when they were in France, they were able to access books written by Karl Marx and other socialists and other revolutionaries. And they became enamored with the idea of sparking a revolution and bringing about equality in their countries. Some called for resistance. Some called for revolution. But almost all of them called for a new state. And then one man appeared that managed to bring all of these cells together. Dr. Sun Yat-sen. Dr. Sun was hands down one of the most articulate advocates for change. He was a member of a group called the Tian Di Hui, which in English is the Heaven and Earth Society. By the 20th century, the Heaven and Earth Society started opening up branches in every single major city in China. And they started recruiting. And they started receiving donations. And soon they began absorbing local cells. To spread his influence, he also traveled. He was one of the few revolutionaries that would actually travel throughout all of China, talking to people, listening to their situations. And he would become revered, respected, even loved by many. And his three principles rang true to everyone in China. The principles of nationalism, so a strong nation. Democracy, letting the people have a say. And of course, the people's livelihoods. The goal, they wanted to expel the barbarians. They wanted to establish a republic and recreate something that the Chinese lost when the Qing took over. The concept of Zhongguo, which is a view that China is the center of the earth, that China is the middle kingdom. It's funny. I had one of my friends back in the 90s. He went over to China doing business. And he brought me back. I said, just get me something that represents, you know, their culture. And he brought me back a map. And I like maps. I love looking at maps. I like touching. I don't like the digital. I like the old-fashioned. Well, he brought me back a Chinese map. A world map. You know our world map? You get a world map. Where's the United States located? Yeah, typically it's right in the middle. Well, this map has China in the middle. But to me, that's just picturesque, because that is the view that many Chinese even today have, that China is the center of the existence, that they are the middle kingdom, and everything else revolves around them. So, Dr. Sun called for seizing power, ending the dynasties, and implemented widespread socialist programs to bring up the standard of living for the poor by redistribution of wealth. But not the Chinese wealth. The wealth held by the foreign countries. And with the leader of the movement, it was only a matter of time before the revolutionaries got organized and started revolting. They were hostile to the Europeans, but they were smart. They learned the lessons of the Boxer Rebellion. Dr. Sun ordered them all not to attack foreign-owned targets, only to attack property, buildings, infrastructure controlled by the Manchus. Just to make it simple, it was like a snowball. Year after year after year, it got more and more and more widespread. The dynasty, just like what had happened to the Ming before the Qing appeared, could not do anything to stop it. Students marched in protest. Government officials were targeted and assassinated. Communication lines were disrupted. Infrastructure was disrupted. But the coup de grace was when the soldiers joined the protesters.
So when the Imperial Army refused to act, the Emperor's office contacted the provincial governors, the warlords, and begged them to help.
To which they said, nah.
In fact, the most powerful of them, Yongxi Kai, he publicly proclaimed an alliance with Dr. Sun.
And they would officially establish a political party known as the Kuomintang.
Or the Chinese Nationalist Party, KMT.
Faced with no military, no way to control the country, an open rebellion that now had the support of the largest military force in all of China, there was only one thing that the dynasty could do. The last emperor, a child, Henry Puyi, as he became known once he got an Anglicanized name, or just Puyi, he was pulled off the throne. He abdicated. And Dr. Sun and Yongxi Kai would establish a political republic known as the Republic of China, and they would establish control over the entire nation. But here's the problem. Just because you have a new government, it didn't mean any of China's problems were fixed. And things only got worse as the 1920s and 1930s rolled along. And it got even worse when Japan invaded and started the second Japanese or Sino-Japanese War, which we call World War II, which of course would give rise to the Chaicoms. And in 1949, the Republic, its control of the mainland would end. But the Chinese Republic still exists. Where?
Taiwan.
But, as far as our discussion, well, what this did, killed the dynastic system, which had been ruling over China for well over 2,500 years. The oldest governing system in human civilization came to an end. All because of the pressure put on them by the Europeans to get money. So, we've carved up Africa. We've destroyed the Ottomans. Mughals got toppled, absorbed when England took over. The Safavids, they were deposed. China, gone. We only got one left. And I'll give you a little bit and then we go home. We've got to see what happened to Japan. Well, ironically, out of all the parts in the world, the only nation to not get taken over was Japan. And how did they avoid it? Part luck, but also part due to the uniqueness of Japanese society itself. All right. Now, just as a reminder, we left off with Japan in the 1600s, when the war of all against all, the Sengoku Jidai, came to an end with the emergence of Tokugawa Ieyasu, who was granted the position of shogun because his family was a cousin of the Minamoto, the ruling family of Japan. For 300 years, the Tokugawa kept Japan isolated from the rest of the world. No nation
other than the Chinese or the Dutch were allowed to do business in Japan. And they were only allowed to go into Nagasaki Bay. They had their version of the Canton system.
Like China, certain exports were banned, certain imports were banned.
Particularly Western books that delved with Christianity.
We talked about this too, how the Tokugawa maintained control. They did so with feudalism, where the Tokugawa would take control of all the fiefs, and if there was a daimyo that was loyal to the Tokugawa, they would be close. If they were an enemy, they would be banished to the farthest points of the island. 6 months out of the year, the daimyos had to live in Edo under the watchful eye of the shogun. But then 6 months, they would have to go back to their home province, but they couldn't take their wife and kids. They had to stay
in the capital. We talked about all that. Law and order was maintained by the samurai. But you know what the problem was? There was no more war. So what does a warrior class do when there is no more war?
Fight. Train.
Well, they trained. They did some politicking. They also drank a lot. And they pretty much did whatever they wanted on the local level, because they kind of became like sheriffs.
No war, people become incompetent. So, complacent.
No. As far as the economy goes, it was completely centralized. Taxes were paid through agricultural production. Rice was money. So you paid your taxes based on giving to the government a portion of your crops. And by the way, those crops were given to the samurai for food. So your taxes went to support the police. But some, one more click after this, two more clicks. Some of the farmers, though, also started doing side hustles. They started producing certain commodities to make extra money. Silk, soy sauce, sake, rapeseed oil. Rapeseed oil is it's a plant, it's ground down, it's kind of like cooking oil. Some artisans engaged in the large-scale production of handmade goods, tools, pottery, clothing, etc. And lastly, some of the daimyo went into banking. But for 300 years, this is how people survived. Chances are you were peasant, so you worked the land. You gave a portion of whatever you produced to the samurai. That's what the samurai lived off of. Law and order was held by the fact that 5% of the population, the samurai, were the only ones allowed to have weapons. And if you were caught with a weapon, you could be killed on the spot. You were allowed to make money if you could produce something that people wanted. But for the most part, this is how life occurred. Life works in any situation, so long as there's no speed bumps. But the problem is every now and then, life has a tendency to go ba-boom. And this is what's going to cause Japan to change. We'll deal with this on Wednesday. Now, one last thought. Tomorrow is election day. If you have not voted and you live close to home, hopefully you do vote. But I want you to do one thing for me. Make, if you are going to vote, an informed choice. I don't care who you vote for. I don't care what causes you vote for, because there's a whole bunch of ballot questions. But If you do not know who you are voting for, don't vote. If you do not know what the ballot questions are, do not vote. Or do the responsible thing, get a little educated, use your little phones, and learn about some of these things. Because an informed decision is a good vote, regardless of who or what's it for. You too.